Hello, I'm Peter Martin from The Economy Stupid. It's your guide to the world of business, buying and decision making, and what it means for your mortgage, your job, your rent, and what you can afford. Because the economy isn't just out there, it's in here. It's in what we do. Search for The Economy Stupid and hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Lixidam Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, could the discovery of a little-known algae species help South Australia recover from a major algal bloom?
So this is actually only the third time it's ever been found anywhere in the world. So it's definitely never been seen in Australia before.
That's the lead researcher behind this discovery. You're going to get a bit of a science lesson from her in just a moment. Then, the Democrats are celebrating a huge win in New York.
My friends, we have toppled a political dynasty.
I think that the message is listen to your voters. When they say that they care about affordability, the cost of living, that's what they care about. You don't have to have, you know, multi-million dollar consultants to tell you what the people are saying.
So what does it mean for the Federal Party in its fight against Donald Trump? The president has got quite the tussle on his hands with the Supreme Court, hearing arguments to ditch his tariff regime. We'll get into that as well. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you for joining The Breakfast Wrap. You're about to hear a whole range of stories presented by Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. And first up, we're going to talk about something called Carinia cristata. I think that's how it's said. You're about to hear from a scientist who definitely knows how to pronounce that. It's an algal species, which scientists say could be behind the brevetoxins detected as part of the algal bloom in South Australia. You would have heard about it here on The Breakfast Wrap. It's caused a downturn in tourism, the state is suffering huge financial losses, and the state and federal governments are pouring $100 million into a summer plan for the bloom. So it could be a really important breakthrough. Now, it's still worth mentioning that it is still undergoing academic peer review. The scientist leading this effort is University of Technology Sydney Professor Shauna Murray. She's been at the head of this research team, and she came on with Sally early this morning to discuss the research.
We started investigating this back in March and when during the first blooms, and we got samples collected by SARDI and PIRSA in South Australia. The South Australian government sent them over. And then since then, we've been working really hard to try and identify the species using a range of different molecular genetic methods and also isolating it and getting it growing in laboratory culture.
And this is a species of algae that's not normally seen in Australian water?
So this is actually only the third time it's ever been found anywhere in the world. So it's definitely never been seen in Australia before.
So this is early days with this research. What's the thinking as to why it's being detected now? Was it maybe there in smaller concentrations and we didn't pick it up? Or is there something about the current conditions that has allowed it to flourish?
It could potentially be both of those things. So we do don't have the information about a basic marine biodiversity in a lot of Australian coastal waters and the oceanic waters. And especially when it comes to microbial species, we can't really say for sure what was there or not there in decades past because we didn't do the research. Chances are good that it's been there for a long time as part of sort of the background flora.
How do we get rid of it?
Well, we won't. It's a microbial species and it's incredibly abundant. So even though the numbers have dissipated now, but at the height of the bloom, there were a million cells per litre of water in some areas in South Australia. So I think what that means is even though the bloom appears to maybe have dissipated slightly in some areas of South Australia, and that the numbers will probably decrease because it doesn't appear to like the warmer conditions as much as the cooler conditions. So it probably won't survive the summer as well. But still, it may be that there are some small remnant populations that survive in some pockets of water. So I don't think we're going to get rid of it, you know, from Australian waters now.
How dangerous can it be for marine life and also for humans? What do we know about this species in particular?
So the Carina cristata produces brevitoxins. So what we did was we isolated the cell into culture and then we tested the production of toxins in culture. And so this is not the first species in the world that produces these types of toxins. There's also a species called Carina brevis. So brevitoxins are neurotoxins. They have various different impacts on the marine life and on humans. And marine life, they can lead to what we've seen, sort of mass deaths of fish and invertebrates, various different parts of the marine ecosystem. And in humans, they can cause respiratory symptoms. And that's been documented in Carina brevis blooms in Florida.
So what's the next steps with this research?
One of them that my laboratory is doing is building faster identification tools that can be potentially used on site. Another aspect that really needs to start to happen now is to understand the sorts of growth conditions that Carina cristata favours, so we can answer those sorts of questions as to whether they like high or low temperatures, high or low nutrient levels, what sort of salinity do they grow best in, that kind of thing. And then we can understand what conditions might cause it and we can better predict it.
And that is University of Technology Sydney Professor Shauna Murray explaining this research into South Australia's algal bloom. And if you want to hear more of our coverage about just what's happening there, just search online for Breakfast Wrap Algal Bloom. You'll be able to listen to the episodes and the interviews that we've done on this story.
New York, tonight you have delivered a mandate for change. A mandate for a new kind of politics. A mandate for a city we can afford.
Well, Zohran Mamdani has rewritten history. He's become the first Muslim mayor of New York City in a win that could mark a real turning point for the Democratic Party. The 34-year-old progressive lawmaker campaigned primarily on economic issues, promising relief from the soaring cost of living, as well as a break from old-style politics. But the win wasn't the only cause for Democratic celebrations yesterday. They secured gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey, and they won a key redistricting battle in California. Now, the president, Donald Trump, has acknowledged the blow to Republicans, but he's blamed it on the government shutdown, which is now the longest in history. So what does it all mean for Democrats? Does this success clarify their path back to the White House, or does it just raise new questions for the party? Former advisor to Barack Obama, Amisha Cross, is now a Democratic strategist. She joined Sally, who asked her this question right up top.
Were you surprised by Zohran Mamdani's victory in New York?
Absolutely not. I think that his primary months ago showcased that this would be the likely result. What Mamdani did was listen to the voices of New Yorkers across all the boroughs. It's the most diverse city in the entire United States. It has one of the largest economies in the world. And it is also a city where people have been crying out about affordability, not being able to pay rent, not being able to afford groceries. He spoke to those issues and made that the central point of his campaign, especially after former or current President Donald Trump ran on reducing the prices of these things. And now you have individuals across the country who don't even have their food stamp benefits and can't afford to feed their children, elderly people who can't afford to eat, veterans who can't afford to eat. He made it make sense for individuals who are looking to government and looking to leadership and saying, in America, we're supposed to have an American dream that takes care of us, our families, and allows us to have a job to earn a living wage. He spoke to what mattered to New Yorkers and honestly, a lot of people around the country.
Are there any messages in that success and that approach, Amisha, for the Democratic Party at the national level?
Absolutely. I think that the message is listen to your voters. When they say that they care about affordability, the cost of living, that's what they care about. You don't have to have, you know, multi-million dollar consultants to tell you what the people are saying. Right now, far too many Americans are feeling as though this country has left them behind. And I think that in Mondani, they saw a level of hope. They saw a message of being able to move past economic frustration. And that was something that they really tied themselves to.
Are voters more willing to vote for significant change at the mayoral level rather than at the presidential level?
I don't think that that's the case. We saw significant change in some ways, Mondani, even though he's obviously on a different side of the political spectrum, in some ways, his campaign mirrored Trump's first campaign. They wanted somebody who was seen as an outsider, somebody who didn't have an elongated political past. They wanted somebody who spoke about change and brought about something that was different. Barack Obama had that same quality. Obviously, these are things that matter to American voters, no matter what city they're in.
Is there a risk of reading too much into this? Because often in these off-year elections, the government does struggle. So is it really a turnaround at the moment?
I think it's a turnaround. The government does struggle, but the government isn't shut down in every off-year election. Currently, in the United States, our government is enduring the longest government shutdown in American history. Those are decisions that were made by the Republicans and the Republican Party. So, yes, I think that this is a referendum on them. But it's not just in New York. We saw it in Virginia. We saw it in New Jersey. We saw it across red states. We also saw it in states like Mississippi, where Republicans basically own the state, where we saw a statewide Black candidate, a Democrat, actually quake into the state Senate in Mississippi, breaking their supermajority. These are issues that extend beyond New York. This is a national game plan. And I think Donald Trump is running scared. And if you look at his Truth Social account today, he has spoken a lot about how he needs to open the government because this has backfired on Republicans.
Democratic strategist Amisha Cross there, speaking to Sally Sara. Well, we're going to stay in the States for just a moment because Donald Trump is facing a threat on another flank, the courts. The US Supreme Court has begun hearing a landmark case on the legality of his sweeping global tariffs. Three lower courts have already ruled his use of emergency powers to be illegal, but the justices, including three appointed by the president himself, will actually have the final say. It's been seen as a major test of presidential power, but a loss could actually force the US to refund billions of dollars to the companies who've already paid the tariffs. Law Professor Kathleen Clawson has worked at the Office of the US Trade Representative. She's also worked at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. She's got both an American and a global perspective on this case. And she explained just why it was so important.
It's significant, particularly for the symbolism of now questioning the president's authority to put these tariffs in place. But to be frank, at the end of the day, he's got a lot of other tools to be able to do this. So I think what we're all watching to see is how the justices take sides with respect to this particular issue. Although if you're importers or if you're in the category of trading partners, perhaps overseas, then I think you're prepared to buckle up for a longer tariff policy, regardless of what the court says here in the coming weeks.
The lawyer representing the Trump administration has been facing sharp questions from the conservative and liberal justices overnight. Are we seeing something of a united front here, perhaps?
Yes, I think it's true that if you listen to the argument, you will hear that it sounded like the government was struggling and that perhaps the president's tariffs will be struck down. But there are a lot of wild cards still at play. A lot of this case comes down to framing. And so the government was trying to suggest that this is an issue about the president's foreign affairs power. And in this instance, these are regulatory tariffs, was the phrase that the advocate used on behalf of the government. This is not, he would say, an issue of tax, which is the other option. Because if it were an issue of tax, if these were revenue tariffs, then it would be pretty clear that the president has exceeded the authority that is afforded to him. So that framing has really shaped the dialogue about the case, and it continues to be the central issue.
And one of the other really interesting aspects of this case, I'm sure a lot of people listening are assuming that this case has been brought by big corporations, but it's been smaller businesses, including a family-owned toy maker. What do we know about why these smaller businesses decided to take the legal action?
That's right. the main plaintiffs here in the case that has gone all the way up are businesses that are about to go out of business. And I think you hit the nail on the head there by indicating that we're not seeing the big companies. And that's, so that it goes both ways. The big companies are perhaps finding other ways to get their point across.
So what might be the dollars and cents here if the Trump administration loses this case? Could there be refunds to those companies that have paid these tariffs?
There could be, and perhaps I should say there should be, but exactly how that would play out would be the next big issue that would follow the justice's decision. There would surely be more litigation. There's a question about timing, because we have a process by which you can protest the amount of tariffs you have paid, and that is on a clock. So I think what we might expect to see here, Sally, is more cases filed in the coming days and weeks. Now, will the Supreme Court speak to the issue of refunds in its forthcoming decision? Probably not. That would be unusual. It might, but we probably would expect that to play out through the lower courts and work its way back up as necessary.
You were just listening to Georgetown University law professor Kathleen Clawson. She's worked at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague and also at the Office of the US Trade Representative. She was speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Let's touch on some federal politics and an update on the Liberal Party's discussions around net zero. The Nationals have dumped their commitment to net zero emissions by 2050, and it's now up to Susan Lee's Liberals to work out if they'll follow or forge a different path. Liberal Shadow Minister Senator Andrew Bragg came on with Sally and told her how quickly this could all be resolved.
Does the Liberal Party have a firm timeframe on when it will be able to get together and finally settle its policy position on emissions?
Well, I think it will be resolved in the next couple of weeks, because we have to deal with these critical issues. It's very important to people that their governments have a plan to reduce emissions, but also to protect their jobs and to ensure the industry remains on shore.
How much difference of opinion is there at the moment ahead of reaching some sort of position here?
Well, I think this has been widely canvassed, and I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think having a democratic debate inside a political party potentially is a good thing, but it does.
Is it inside, though? It's been spilling out?
Well, I think it now needs to be brought to a head and resolved. I think because it is harming our ability to hold the government to account, because this is chewing up so much energy. And let's be honest, I mean, the government is failing across a number of areas.
Has Susan Lee's leadership, has it lost a bit of skin through all of this?
No, I mean, this is what Susan said that she was going to do. There's going to be this internal debate, and we've had it, and then it's almost finished.
Have you had it?
Well, while we're having it.
Is there much tension at the moment, would you say?
I mean, these are policy issues. They're not personal. I mean, people have different views, and these have been issues that have been the subject of great disagreement for some time. But I would say to you, like, in terms of the community's view, I mean, the community is worried about climate change. The community is worried about Australia's role in how that all pans out. And I think they want to see us have a serious agenda here. I think they want to see us have a goal. And I think we should reflect carefully on that.
Have senior members of the Liberal Party room seen the final report from Dan Tehan as yet, his review into this policy?
No, Dan is still working on that.
When do you expect to see that?
Well, I imagine we'll see it soon, because this will be resolved this parliamentary year. And as you know, we're running out of runway.
You sure are. Yeah, the time is running out. We've got, after this, one more sitting week.
That's right. Mm.
Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg there. So he clearly wants this resolved this year. Our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, explained why the Liberals want this wrapped up so soon.
There is no doubt that whether you're a moderate like Andrew Bragg or from the conservative wing of the Liberal Party, they all want this done by the end of the year. And we're getting to that crunch point. Today is the last day of a fortnight of Parliament we've had sitting, a pretty turbulent fortnight.
Oh, yes.
There's one more week that is scheduled, and that's the last week of November. That will be the last scheduled meeting for the Liberal Party to get together as a whole. That's the last opportunity this year to sort out the policy and sort out leadership questions. So this is crucial. But the timing is also, there's a lot of pressure on that final week for the work of the parliament. And on the government side, we've got the government pressing very hard. Exactly. The Prime Minister is pressing very hard, and they are determined to get environment law reform passed by the end of the year. So we've got a lot of examination going on within the Liberal Party about the coinciding of these two things, because however it's going to play out, there's going to be some diminution of the Liberals' commitment to net zero. Either it's going to be watered down or possibly dumped altogether. Either way, that's damaging for the party's credentials with urban voters who've consistently shown that they support action to tackle climate change. Now, the Liberals are very aware of the risk of the perception of or being painted as blocking efforts to update environment laws as well as dumping a net zero commitment. So there are senior Liberal MPs from both the moderate and conservative wings, so this includes senior conservative MPs, who think that the Liberals might have to support the environment laws if they want to be able to have some credentials in this space. Now, that is raising the hopes in the government of their aim of getting this deal done this year. We are going to have, in the next fortnight, several days of hearings about these environment laws, all before Parliament comes back. That last week of Parliament sitting, it's generally known as the killing season, and there'll be questions about Susan Lee's leadership, but might also become known as the deal-making season.
Sounds like quite the telly show. Mel Clark there with the latest analysis on the Liberal Party's net zero discussions. Well, another big Auspol story is the growing list of platforms under the government's social media ban for children under 16. You probably already know about TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, but how much do you know about Reddit and Kik? Computer science expert Dr. Erica Mealy came on to explain.
Reddit is a slightly different kettle of fish because it's really like a bulletin board, the old bulletin boards that were around when we were kids, when we were online. But honestly, I've been heard many times to call Reddit the toilet of the internet. There's a lot of really unsavory content that happens on Reddit. I was surprised it wasn't in the first round of ones named. But Kik is more a streaming platform. And so it's about users being able to reach really large audiences, broadcast live and share their messages. And I think the live part is the really problematic part because it's very hard to protect our kids when it's live. But it's kind of also interesting because there's some really big players in this space that haven't been included that are very similar to Kik that's just been included.
And also Amazon-owned Twitch, that's a very popular video streaming platform, sort of similar in some ways to YouTube or Kik. Do we know why it's currently not on the government's list?
The best we can tell at the moment seems to be its Australian-based popularity, but they have been at pains to say that it is a dynamic list. But it is confusing to me why online gaming has been particularly carved out when we look at the motivation for this bill. And I mean, we all want to protect our kids. That makes a great deal of sense. And we're looking at some of these addictive behaviors, you know, the doom scrolling and sitting there on your phone and antisocial, and why it's got a carve out, particularly for gaming, which is why Twitch hasn't been included, it's suggested, and also why Discord, which is another messaging app, hasn't been included, it's suggested. It's a really muddy place to be.
And yesterday, the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, played down concerns that the ban on under-16s could diminish connections between kids and their friends. What do you think about that?
My concern is that we're looking at protecting the mental health of our young people, and online bullying is not something that's happening publicly. So that's in the shadows, that's in the private messages. And I really worry about our kids that are outside the metropolitans, because we do know that they do use some of these social media type platforms to seek assistance and support and connection when we're talking about rural, regional and remote kids. So it is a concern where we're drawing lines and why we're drawing lines. And the other side for me is, why are we taking agency away from parents?
Bit of food for thought there from Dr. Erica Mealy. She's a senior lecturer in computer science at the University of the Sunshine Coast. She's also a former board member of Electronic Frontiers Australia. That is the Breakfast Wrap for today. Thank you very much for listening. As always, you can listen to the live Radio National Breakfast program every morning from 5:30 a.m. And you can catch the Breakfast Wrap sometime after that on the ABC Listen app and also on Radio National. Every interview you heard was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the wonderful ABC Radio National Breakfast team. And the Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Asher. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and make sure you're back here tomorrow for the last show of the week.